morning, everybody. You are listening to KBOO Portland. The time is 9:59, about to be 10 o'clock. Up next, we have Flashpoints with Dennis Bernstein at 11. It's Between the Covers with David Naiman. Talks to author Sheila Hady, who asks, what is gain and what is lost when a woman becomes a mother in her new novel, Motherhood? At 11:30, Words and Pictures talks to sculptor, composer, and animator John Frame about his work on Portland Opera's new production of Faust. We want to thank KBOO members for your support. To keep informed and get involved, go to kboo.fm and click donate to become a member.
Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of the Four Peaks Music Festival, taking place Thursday, June 21st through Sunday, June 24th in Bend, Oregon. The 11th annual Four Peaks Music Festival features two stages, a kids area, and a junction area for gathering and jamming. Performers include Green Sky Bluegrass, the North Mississippi All-Stars, Poor Man's Whiskey, Molly Tuttle, and many, many more. Again, that's the Four Peaks Music Festival taking place Thursday, June 21st through Sunday, June 24th in Bend, Oregon. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events.
Flashpoints, we celebrate the work of professor and author Sunaina Mera. First, we'll feature a recent interview with her from the Electronic Intifada podcast with host Nora Barrels Friedman. Then, we'll feature an excerpt of a talk given a few months ago in the Bay Area for her latest book, Boycott, The Academy and Justice for Palestine. My name is Mike Biggs. All this straight ahead on Flashpoints. Stay tuned. You're listening to Flashpoints on Pacifica Radio. Up first, we feature a recent interview with Nora Barrows Friedman of the Electronic Intifada podcast with Sunaina Mera. Listen to this.
I'm here in Oakland with scholar and author Sunaina Mera. She is a professor of Asian American Studies at UC Davis and is on the organizing collective for the U.S. Campaign for the Academic and Cultural Boycott of Israel, U.S. ACBI. She's also a founding member. Sunaina is also the author of the new book, Boycott, The Academy and Justice for Palestine, published by the University of California Press. And that's what we're going to be talking about today. Sunaina, thank you so much for being with us on the Electronic Intifada podcast.
I'm thrilled. Thank you, Nora.
So the book is a well-researched, elegantly structured documentation of the academic boycott as part of the larger boycott, divestment, and sanctions campaign called by Palestinian civil society. You zero in on the boycott movement within U.S. academia, how it began, its role in challenging the dominant Israel-centered narrative, and how scholars are fighting against what you call the archive of repression that we can get into later, which is the incessant, unrelenting backlash by those who wish to keep the dominant Zionist narrative dominant. Let's begin by having you lay out what the academic boycott is in relation to the broader BDS campaign and how it's helping to steadily shift that narrative.
Sure, yeah. So the academic boycott was called for by Palestinian intellectuals and scholars in 2004, so a year before the larger call for BDS was issued from Palestine. And it calls on the international community to boycott Israeli academic institutions until Israel complies with the three principles of BDS. And as with the BDS movement at large, those principles are ending the occupation and colonization of Arab lands, occupied in 1967, respecting the rights of Palestinian citizens of Israel to full equality and respecting the right of return of refugees. And I think these are significant because, you know, it really has been decades since these very basic human rights principles were even discussed in the U.S. university. And so the academic boycott movement was, you know, was an opportunity for U.S. academics to end the complicity of the U.S. university with Israel until it complies with these basic principles of human rights. And I just want to add that it's really important to note that this was meant to be a boycott of Israeli institutions, so not of individual Israeli academics or Jewish Israeli scholars or Jewish American scholars, as, you know, the opponents of the boycott have sometimes alleged.
You write about the ways in which Israel is presented in mainstream academia and how even presenting the Palestinian narrative is instantly seen as controversial. How did this position on Israel become so mainstreamed in the university and really the only acceptable position to have?
That's a very good point. It's actually normative. It has been normative for many years. The only acceptable and kind of legitimate and civil position, if you will, is to actually support Israel and to refrain from any criticism of the Israeli state. And I think, you know, that status quo has been maintained the same way that the status quo in general discourse in the U.S. has been maintained, you know, due on the one hand to the power of the Zionist lobby. So, you know, the university is actually very susceptible to interventions by off-campus pro-Israel groups. And so I think by now, you know, there's this whole, you know, archive we have of documentation of the ways in which, you know, Zionist organizations have pressured university administrators to, you know, fire or censor, you know, academics who are doing work on their campuses that might be deemed critical of Israel, to discipline students. So I think it's the force of what the International Jewish Anti-Zionist Network, IJAN, calls the Zionist Backlash Network, you know, this web of organizations that constantly intervenes in academic freedom. That's one thing. On the other side, I think, is the vulnerability of U.S. academics to censure and defamation. And so, you know, academics as a class, I think, are very vulnerable or feel they're very vulnerable to any kind of public criticism or defamation. And because I think, you know, on this particular issue in the larger sphere, you know, in the U.S., there also is not a lot of sympathy to an honest account of Palestine-Israel. It means academics really have tended to toe the line. So when I entered the academy, by the way, you know, about 15 years ago, and I started teaching, you know, I remember people saying, you know, don't touch the P word, don't utter the word Palestine in your classroom. And so I think that, you know, as the U.S. university has also become increasingly reliant on adjunct labor and tenure-track positions are really difficult to get, and tenure is hard, you know, to attain. I think that this makes, you know, this kind of censorship and lockdown of Palestine-Israel a kind of baton that people can wield over U.S. academics because they feel insecure academically.
I really appreciated reading about how you analyzed the propaganda war to protect Israel's image, both by the Israeli government itself, but also by its civilian front here in the U.S. and abroad. Stephen Salaita, the author, academic, and contributor to the Electronic Intifada, who is the notorious subject of a campaign by Israel-aligned forces to oust him from academia because of his outspoken criticism of Israel and Zionism. Steve says, and you quote him in your book, that groups such as the Anti-Defamation League have used the language of liberal humanism and tolerance, civil rights, and anti-racism to promote and consolidate that support for Israel as a prerequisite of responsible multicultural citizenship, which is nowhere more evident than in the academy. Can you talk about how Israel and its supporters have really weaponized this language and how the academic boycott works to challenge it?
Right. I think that's a very important point. And, you know, Stephen unfortunately knows too well how that has been weaponized and used to kind of really deepen the situation of academic insecurity. But I think the point that he makes in that quote in the book is actually really important, because what he was sort of trying to point out is that, you know, it's actually support for Israel, a foreign state, not the U.S. state, by the way, that has actually become a core element of responsible multicultural citizenship in the United States. And so if you are critical of Israel, you're deemed anti-Semitic, therefore you are racist, and therefore you're not a good multicultural citizen. And so on college campuses where the discourse of multiculturalism is so prevalent, I think the ways in which supporters of Israel, I like the way you know, sort of pointed out that it's a civilian front, you know, of Israel, because, you know, they get funding from the Israeli government. The ways in which supporters of Israel have actually managed to consolidate that embargo on criticism of Israel is by making criticism of Israel you know, outside the pale of, you know, proper university behavior and protocols. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there has been legislation that Title VI legislation that has actually made, you know, criticism of Israel anti-Semitic in college campuses. And so, you know, they've used lawfare on the one hand to try to basically, you know, penalize universities that are deemed to somehow foster, you know, the so-called anti-Semitic critique of Israel. That hasn't worked. But I think what has worked is actually a kind of cultural, you know, hegemony in which, you know, criticism of Israel is just not permissible. So it's what I talked about earlier. It's people telling other people or whispering to other people, just don't do that event, just don't bring that speaker. And so I think it's that kind of, you know, sort of just cultural understanding that this is something that one should just not engage in because, as you said, it's considered too controversial, that has made that the norm. And then I think on the other hand, I just want to also note that we also do know that the U.S. is a special ally of Israel. So this support is also coming from the state. And I think that that is also very powerful, that in other issues, one can be openly critical of China or, you know, Sudan or, you know, other states without necessarily worrying about the extent of, you know, punitive backlash.
Mm-hmm. And how does the boycott campaign address that?
Right. I mean, and I think that was the second part of your question, which is really key. So I think the way in which the boycott has challenged that lockdown is by, you know, creating awareness and discussion about Palestine and Israel. And I think because it is a tool, it's not exactly a movement that, you know, people can sort of deploy in different contexts. It's allowed students to organize divestment campaigns and to mobilize student bodies to actually, you know, confront what's really happening in Palestine. The academic boycott in particular, I think, is very powerful because I think the movement emerged at a time when academics were beginning to get slightly fed up of the censorship. You know, I mean, academics are intellectuals. Not all of them are Zionists, actually. And so I think people were just getting kind of fatigued, you know, that there was, you know, this constant silencing and, you know, harassment. And so I think the academic boycott allowed academic associations to take a position. And I think I talk in the book a little bit about why I think this is a war of position, because I think it's about shifting the parameters of cultural discourse and, you know, intellectual discourse. And so, you know, when the ASA, the American Studies Association, endorsed an academic boycott resolution in 2013, it became clear that, you know, critical scholars were actually deeply concerned about Palestine. And so it really shattered the taboo on criticism of Israel by creating a space for discussion.
Mm-hmm. We're here with Sunaina Mehra. She is a professor at UC Davis and also the author of Boycott, The Academy and Justice for Palestine. You mentioned the war of position, and that's a theory by the great late Italian communist writer Antonio Gramsci, the war of position versus the war of maneuver. Can you talk a little bit about that more and how you bring that in to talk about the context of BDS as a tactic and a tool?
Right. So, in fact, one of the things that I say in the book is that, you know, the war of position is the struggle to challenge dominant cultural beliefs in contrast to the war of maneuver or open war and armed attack. And it's been key to understanding the successes of the boycott as a social movement that has challenged the hegemony of Israel. So, as we've been, you know, discussing, that has been based on a set of popular beliefs that normalize the policies of Israel. And so I think the ways in which I see the BDS movement reflecting on it, you know, over the last 10 years now is that I think what it has been instrumental in is doing is through these kind of small incremental steps, really challenging the normalization of this kind of Israeli exceptionalism in the U.S. And so I think in that regard, it's very important because, you know, Israel itself is very concerned with this war of position. So it's very apparent. I mean, they themselves talk about the fact that, you know, they're deeply worried about what they call delegitimization of Israel. And so there's a war of legitimacy. And I think it's very important to note in this regard, by the way, that this is not about the existence of the Israeli state, okay? I mean, because there's all this kind of really melodramatic, you know, kind of allegations that BDS is out to destroy the state of Israel. But I think if we think about the three principles of BDS, it's fair to say that they point out the fundamental flaws in the notion of Israel as a self-professed democratic state that, you know, affords equality to its citizens. And so in that regard, I think, you know, BDS has provided a discourse that now people can pick up and use to challenge that exceptionalization of Israel as being above critique. And so going back to the point about multiculturalism, I think one of the things that Israel has also tried to do through its Brand Israel campaign is to kind of present the image of being multicultural and cool and gay friendly and, I don't know, women friendly and worker friendly and African friendly and all of these things, which are not true. And so I think, again, the BDS movement, I think, has provided, you know, kind of ordinary people with a language that they can use to basically, you know, rupture this kind of myth. Mm-hmm.
As you said, and as you write, the role of BDS is providing that language. And it's a textbook example of a social justice movement like any other, but has received a minuscule fraction of the recognition and research. And here's where the scholarship on BDS and the Palestinian liberation struggle overlaps with the fight against neoliberalism in the U.S. academy, increasing privatization, and the censorship of academic research or basic activism on campus, as you said. Can you talk about the role of BDS? A little bit more about how we can talk about BDS as a central player, you know, in